Good morning. We're going to adjust the pulpit situation just a little bit. Make sure we're recording. Okay. You know, we have all our services are recorded. You can always go back and listen. If there's something you try to remember, what did that doggone minister say? You can always go back and listen. And then you could quote me and throw it right back. Well, Christmas was a relatively minor holiday for almost 1,000 years in the Christian calendar. Easter was far more important. That was the centerpiece of the year. But if you look at the New Testament, it's not difficult to find basic elements of the Christmas that we know today. There's no Christmas trees, ribbon, wrappings, or reindeer, but you will find presents and even a sort of Grinch. Here's the Gospel of Matthew. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, magi from the east, who might have been sorcerers, astrologers, or some people even say mathematicians, the magi came to Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who's been born king of the Jews? For we've seen his star in the east and we've come to worship him." Now, Herod had been pretty certain that he was the king of the Jews. So he consults with his own wise men, priests and scribes, who are more into literature than math or stars. They're sort of the liberal arts majors, the guys who are coming kind of the STEM magi. They check their old scrolls and discover that indeed there is an old prophecy about a major ruler rising from the minor town of Bethlehem. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly, and he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him." Old Herod is so smart and so slick that he thinks up that lie of his awfully quick. Later, he'll show himself to be even more wicked than the Grinch when he tries to steal Christmas by killing all the baby boys born recently in the neighborhood. But for now, here are the presents brought from even further than Mount Crumpet. When they had heard the king, the magi went their way, and lo, the star which they'd seen in the east went before them, till it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, and frankincense, and myrrh. Babies just love these things, especially myrrh. So Christmas is off to a good start, even if it takes 1,000 more years to become a major church and family holiday. Likewise, Hanukkah was for centuries a very minor celebration in the Jewish ritual year compared to major holidays like Passover and Yom Kippur. It has also grown in recent times into an important celebration of Jewish identity and a fun time for kids of all ages. Like the Christmas stories that I've just read, it has its dark side, as well as those lights shining through in the distance. In a few moments, I'll share a bit of both with you, the light and the dark. But for now, let's hear Deborah play. Thank you. That was really sweet. Really sweet. Well, someone once asked a rabbi, "Rabbi, please tell me, why do rabbis always seem to answer a question with a question?" To which the rabbi replied, "And why should a rabbi not answer a question with a question?" The Hanukkah story that most of us have heard, and the one that's most fun to share with children, is one that does not come from the Bible. Rather, it comes from the Babylonian Talmud. Babylon is in today's Iraq, right? A collection of religious and civil law gathered by rabbis of the 5th century of the Common Era and presented in a constant back and forth of questions, answers, and then more questions. So it should be no surprise that the story of Hanukkah, the way the rabbis tell it, begins with a question. What is Hanukkah? The rabbis taught, on the 25th day of Kislev, Hanukkah commences and lasts 8 days, on which lamenting, in commemoration of the dead, and fasting are prohibited. When the Hellenists entered the sanctuary, they defiled all the oil that was found there. When the government of the house of Asmoneans prevailed and conquered them, oil was sought to feed the holy lamp in the sanctuary. And only one vial was found with the seal of the high priest intact. The vial contained sufficient oil for one day only, but a miracle occurred. And it fed the holy lamp 8 days in succession. These 8 days were the following year established as days of good cheer, on which psalms of praise and acknowledgement of God's wonders were to be recited. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if this passage leaves you with some questions. A lot of funny terms in there. One question might be about time. When is the month of Kislev? If you look it up in the dictionary, you'll find it listed as both the 3rd month of the civil year and the 9th month of the religious year in the Jewish calendar, which may leave you with still more questions. 9th or 3rd, which is it? But there seems to be little question about the spirit of the time in question. There is to be no mourning for the dead during Hanukkah. If we remember our dead, and who could forget them during the holidays? We should remember them joyfully. Joyfully. A toast to Raul. To Betty. To Joe. A toast. A happy toast. There should be no lamentation. No fasting. We should eat and enjoy our food. Food prepared with oil in memory of the temple oil, things like potato latkes. Yes, they're fattening, but relax a little, say the rabbis. These days are mandated to be days of good cheer. For once, the law seems to prescribe that we have some fun. There's a strong element of play in Hanukkah. What's not to enjoy in lighting one more candle each evening 8 times in a row? Actually, we find in the Talmud that, surprise, some rabbis had serious questions about how the candle should be handled. Rabbi, how to handle the candles? Well, Rabbi, let me tell you how to handle the candles. Rabbi Shammai taught that all of the candles should be lit on the first night, and then their number should be reduced each night thereafter. Rabbi Hillel, who's famous for the saying, "If I am not for myself, who will be for me? When I am for myself, what am I? And if not now, when?" That rabbi argued that we should start with one candle, then add one each night until they're all lit. The rabbis reached a compromise: to follow the practice of Hillel until the Messiah comes, and then follow the practice of Shammai. Well, he hasn't come yet, so we follow Hillel. Messiah or no Messiah, the rabbis were unanimous that we should do no work with the candles and also do no work by their light. So what should we do? One of the things that we should do is something that the rabbis usually said we shouldn't. We should gamble a little for fun. For nuts or raisins maybe, or maybe a little money, either real coins or later coins made of chocolate, Hanukkah gelt, right? for fun, gamble for fun, and with, what's the instrument that we use? A dreidel, right? And with a dreidel, which is a kind of a goofy square-sided top. Each side is inscribed with letters that stand for the Hebrew words Nes Gadol Hayasham. A great miracle happened there. In Israel today, some dreidels substitute one of the letters, so it stands for Nes Gadol Hayapo. A great miracle happened here. Here or there, dreidels point to the miracle of the oil that burned for 8 days when there should have only been enough for one. And it's this miraculous sufficiency that the rabbis wanted us to take to heart. Oil for 1 day burned for eight. Amazing. There's a special joy in such an experience that's different from the confidence that comes from having a full warehouse, a full bank account, a full tank of gas for a fairly short trip. One of my favorite episodes of Seinfeld. Do you all know Seinfeld? Oh, pretty good. Okay. One of my favorite episodes has Kramer shopping for a car when he has no real intention to buy. He just wants to drive one around. I think it's an Audi. He starts a conversation with a salesman who accompanies him on a test drive and shares his observation that there always seems to be some gas in the tank, even when it shows empty. And the salesman is intrigued. They keep driving until the needle almost bottoms out, a bond growing between them as they take this goofy gamble together. If you know your Seinfelds, you can now picture Kramer. You can imagine his goofy, square-sided face as he plunges into yet another goofy scheme. As they approach the highway exit that would take them back to the car dealership, Kramer says something to the effect of, "What if we just keep on going?" With moist eyes, they take each other's hands, and reenacting the final scene of Thelma and Louise, where Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon rode straight off a cliff with the police in pursuit. But now they just zoom past the exit, running on fumes, off into the great beyond. Now let's take each other's hand for a moment, if you're comfortable doing so. If you don't have a cold or flu or something. I hope I haven't zoomed right past you with too many pop cultural references, but my point is to share what the rabbis say is the heart of Hanukkah, the joy of unexpected, almost miraculous sufficiency. It's something that we might feel around any holiday or any other time, really. The feeling, the weird feeling, that this is enough. This is enough. There's enough within me, around me, and yes, beside me, right here, right now, to let me go the whole way, as preposterous as that might seem. This little bit of fuel, this neighbor's hand filled with nothing but my hand, and a bit of human warmth. Nothing more is required except that I affirm it from the bottom of my heart. When this happens for a family or a community, then it's time for some singing down here in Whoville. And some fried food. And some chocolate. So I guess I've answered the rabbi's question, what is Hanukkah? You can release each other's hands now. Because I'm going to be kind of backwards. My last sermon sort of started serious and ended up funny. Uh-oh. Well, we've answered the question, what is Hanukkah? Not quite. We've enjoyed the story of the wonderful oil, but we haven't considered the larger story of which it is a part. We're back to the Talmud now. When the Hellenists entered the sanctuary, they defiled all the oil that was found there. When the government of the house of Asmoneans prevailed and conquered them, oil was sought to feed the holy lamp in the sanctuary, and only one vial was found with the seal of the high priest intact. So who are these Hellenists in the house of Asmonean, the Asmoneans? The Hellenists here are Greek-speaking Syrians of the 2nd century of the Common Era. These Greco-Syrians had conquered much of Israel and taken control of the temple in Jerusalem. That's where the oil was, and the lamp. And now we finally come to the part of the Hanukkah story that is found in the Bible. Sort of. It's found in some Bibles, in the 1st and 2nd book of Maccabees, which is another name for the Asmoneans. And I hope that you're not confused now, because it's going to get worse. Neither book is found in the Hebrew Bible, the Bible of the Jews. The books of Maccabees were written in Greek, which was the language of most Jews at the time, just as it was for Syrians. So when they cussed each other out, both sides had to do it in Greek. And there was a lot to cuss about. When the Syrians took the temple, they're said to have stolen all of its treasures, the silver and gold. They also began to sacrifice on its altar to their own gods, who seem to have favored the blood of pigs, of course, considered unclean animals by Jews. As we've heard already, they also stole the jars of sacred olive oil. The story tells us that some Jews came to accept the new state of affairs. They stopped circumcising their sons, just as they'd been ordered by the government, and some even began to participate in the new ruler's sacrifices. Others resisted, and many were put to death. Still, others managed to escape, and they began to plot a rebellion. Among these, one Mattathias, the son of a Judean priest, along with his sons, began to rebel openly against Greco-Syrian authority. They started by publicly tearing their clothes and putting on sackcloth. Back then, no less than today, public acts of mourning often serve as staging ground for more violent acts of protest. Right? We see this every week, where often the attack on the funeral is bigger than the attack that led to the funeral. Right? These violent acts of protest begin when Mattathias gives, quote, vent to righteous anger, as the book calls it, and kills a fellow Jew who had participated in the pagan rites. Attacking those of our own who seem to collaborate with the enemy before we dare to attack the actual enemy is also nothing new. Check the news today or any day, and you'll find that happening. Mattathias and sons now take to the hills and start making raids to attack other collaborators. They forcibly circumcise all uncircumcised males, Jews or Gentiles, whom they catch within the border of Israel. What do you say, amen or ouch? And then they do battle with the Syrians. When Mattathias dies, he passes command to his son Judas, who is also called Maccabeus. Or hammer. This is not the Judas of the gospel stories. Way before. Maccabeus, the Maccabees, right? The hammers, hammerheads. Judas takes the battle forcibly to the Syrians, or the Gentiles, as the book calls them, and with his forces manages to retake the temple. What next? Well, that's a very good question. Here's from the book of Maccabees. They purified the temple, removing to an unclean place the stones which defiled it. They discussed what to do with the altar of burnt offering, which was profaned, which means the swine and other beasts which were abominable to Hebrews had bled and died there. And they rightly decided to demolish it for fear it might become a standing reproach to them because it had been defiled by the Gentiles. They therefore pulled down the altar and stowed away the stones in a fitting place on the temple hill until a prophet should arise who could be consulted about them. They took unhewn stones, as the law commands, and built a new altar on the model of the previous one. Here's where the rabbis begin the story about the miraculous container that fed the temple lamp for 8 days with oil that it should only have lasted for one. The book of Maccabees itself, though, says nothing about the oil. Rather, it goes on to tell us about the Syrian counterattack and all the battles that follow. It also tells us that Judas the Hammer continued to purge Israel of other remnants of Syrian religion while also pounding down those Jews who he felt had betrayed their faith. He meets with such success in these campaigns that he decides to go one step further in his campaign to make Israel great again. Judas turned aside to the land of the Philistines. He tore down their altars and the graven images of their gods. He burned with fire. He plundered the cities and returned to the land of Judah. The story fails to mention that the Philistines of this time were at peace with Israel. Do you know how to say Philistine in English? Palestinian. They were just good neighbors, sitting quietly at home when the hammer came, looking for someone to nail. It's one thing when the fire of the Spirit burns longer and carries us farther than we ever expected to go, when the oil for one night burns for eight. That's something to celebrate with bright lights and singing. It's quite another thing when the fire of our spirit starts burning other people's homes. What to call that is a very good question indeed. One thing I wouldn't call it is a holiday, a holy day. Does it sound like something that you could celebrate? Let me answer this question with the rabbi's question about the candles. Should we light a new one every evening until the menorah is all aglow? Or should we start with all eight burning and blow one out each night until it's gone dark? When it comes to religious enthusiasm, many of us are more inclined toward blowing candles out. We're cautious. We've seen the devastation of too much religious fire, and it gives us pause. But let's not go too far in the opposite direction from the Maccabees. Let's be careful about being too careful, religiously speaking. We need some confidence in our candles. They're right up here where we can keep an eye on them, or at least some of them are. Please take a moment now to pause and close your eyes. Feel the energy in your body, your mind, the whole of your being. That's not just a metaphor. That's something real. Stay there for a moment. Come on back. Yeah, come on back. How was that? We're so much more. We are so much more than the words we speak, the work we do, the property that we accumulate and care for. I hope you felt that just now. Your presence is something real. There's an energy. There's a power. It's very personal, yes, but it's also something that can be intentionally shared. Or it can be withheld, almost out of habit. It's your candle. What are you going to do with it? Light it? Nurture it? Or blow it out? Our fourth religious principle is acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. In our congregations, not just at home, not just in private. Congregating is the very core of our religious practice. when we don't come together, or if too many of us just don't bother, the light we share as a congregation may seem like it's failing. Others feel discouraged. Where is everybody? What's wrong? But when many gather, as we often do, especially around the holidays, we feel enlivened, energized, charged up. Imagine a Sunday with full attendance by every member and friend. Imagine that that could be every Sunday. Remember the Grinch? Remember him? He's withheld himself from WHO society for 53 years. Now, who wouldn't want to take a break from the WHOs now and then? Otherwise, you could choke on all the chipper. I could see Jerry Seinfeld doing some routine with the WHOs. But in the end, the Grinch learns that the holiday is so much more than its trappings. The most important thing he can bring to the celebration is what? Do you remember? It's himself. It's himself. Down from Mount Crumpet and into the feast he comes at last, to the congregation, where he, the Grinch himself, carves the roast beast. Sharing his living presence is enough, and more than enough. It's the essential thing. It's almost miraculously sufficient. May such miraculous sufficiency fill you and surround you and keep you in the coming year. And may you keep coming here to share it with us as often as you really can. Light one candle, blow it out, then light two next time. Bring your friends whenever you can, no matter who. Tell them that we get to play with fire here. Play with fire, real spiritual fire, but that we're always very careful with it. Happy holidays to you, and you, and you, and you, and Cindy Lou too. Amen.